supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Show. A gentleman in Tennessee wants to make the world's biggest living flag out of plants, specifically blooming trees. But where do you go to get the color blue? We'll tell you what we came up with when we do the question of the week. In the meantime, though, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens. We're going to take that heaping helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Tricia, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
I am doing just fine, thank you. Trish, how are you?
I'm just doing wonderful, thank you.
And where is Trish wonderful?
In Hillsborough, New Jersey.
Okay, what can we do for you?
Well, we have, and I almost want to say had, but two fig trees in the yard. One was a brown turkey fig, and the other a white fig. Last summer, the brown turkey fig, which was an older tree, started having a lot of ants in it. And every time you picked a piece of fruit or you go to pick a piece of fruit, there were ants crawling all inside of it. And, you know, we sort of put it aside to the extreme heat last summer. We didn't know what was going on with it. Now, spring is here. My white fig tree is doing wonderfully. The brown turkey fig is dead.
Oh.
Yeah, it's very sad. We had visions of making wonderful fig spread, and now my fig tree is gone.
I'm not surprised. Ants are an occasional pest of figs themselves. You know, for various reasons, who knows why, but a colony gets started nearby. Typically, ants don't go after fruits like this, but of course, once they get started, they're transmitting chemical messages to the rest of the colony. I would have urged you, as soon as this became a problem, to put out a lot of boric acid bait traps.
Okay.
And destroy the colony by getting this slow-acting poison to the queen. Not poisonous to us, but poisonous to ants. Boric acid is a great natural method of ant control. But obviously, if the tree hasn't greened up yet, it is really most sincerely dead. So what
it
do you
is very sad, yes.
What do you want to do here?
So now what we'd like to do is the location where we have the dead tree is where we want to move the live white fig tree to. But we're concerned that we didn't know what killed the tree. I didn't think that it was the ants. We thought maybe it was a fungus. Do we need to treat the soil? What do we need to do to prepare to move the white fig and have the best results? Should we do it now or later?
Oh, God, no. No. This is the time. It's forming all the figs. It's doing all its stuff. Very easy to move a fig tree. I agree with you that I don't, or I'm suspicious that it was the ants, that something's wrong with the site. Have we dug up the old dead tree?
Not yet. We'll do that this weekend.
Let's dig up the old dead tree. God knows what you could find under there. And no, there's no reason to believe there's any fungus in the soil. Figs are extremely hardy. You know, I just wonder if maybe there wasn't an ant and a termite war underneath. So let's see what the post-mortem of the fig is. Now, why do you want to move another fig over to this spot, though? I'm a little confused.
Well, because the place that we selected for the fig tree, as it's starting to grow and spread, we realize it does not have enough room to really spread the way it would like.
Mm-hmm.
So the area that we had, the other fig tree, and it's just perfect for it to do that. And I'd rather not keep pruning it and cutting it back. I'd rather just let it go and do
what
it
know,
wants to do.
A fig tree in New Jersey is always going to need some pruning in the spring to take care of winter damage. And it's
okay.
And it's good for the tree. There's nothing wrong with an annual cutting back as soon as the tree begins to green up in the spring. You know, because if you don't wrap it, if it's and even in a protected area, it's always going to suffer some winter dieback, you know, typically at the top. And one of the best things you can do for the health of the tree is remove all the winter damaged parts and give it a nice haircut in the spring. That really encourages good growth and good fruit set. Well, here's what we're going to do. First, get rid of the dead tree, examine the soil. If you can't see anything wrong, just leave it. And then at the end of this season, when your tree is done producing, you have two options. It is not unusual for Italians to actually take their fig tree kind of out of the ground for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So what they typically do is they would dig a trench next to the tree. Not a really deep trench, but just in, you know, an impression, a depression. And then they would soak the soil real well with a garden hose for hours and then just rock the tree out of the ground, lay it down sideways and cover it with soil, maybe some carpeting, and dig it up again in the spring. You could do the same thing, and in the spring, when the tree is at its most lively, when it really wants to grow and thrive, that would be the time to simply move it over to the new place, give it a nice pruning, and see how it does. Okay. I would also take a lot of cuttings from the white fig in the spring after it's situated in its new spot and it's regrowing again. I would take a lot of cuttings and root them just to make sure we could keep the genetic structure of the tree in case the same thing happened again.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Mike.
All right, Trish, good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you, Bill. How are you?
Oh, very well. I was listening to your show on Saturday or Sunday, I'm not sure, and it was fascinating, all the information that you know about a lot of different things. I thought you might know about my problem.
Where are you, Bill?
Right now, I'm on the beach in Emerald Isle, North Carolina, but my problem is back home in Budlake, New Jersey.
Okay, Emerald Isle, North Carolina. We helped somebody not that long ago who was having a problem growing kiwi on Emerald Isle. And your gardening question, however, is back in New Jersey.
Yes, sir, it is.
All right.
Last fall in October, we had a very heavy snowfall. It knocked down a crabapple ornamental tree. So I had a contractor come with a backhoe and lift it up and secure it back in the ground with some posts and some cord, rope, and stuff like that. About a month ago, in a very, very heavy rainfall, followed by heavy winds, it pulled the supports out of the ground and fell over again. So this time, I used the car jack and increasingly longer lengths of wood, cranked it back up, used come-alongs, put it back up, and secured it much more firmly than before. But everybody keeps on telling me that it's not going to live and cut it up for firewood and you're wasting your time. And so I'm looking for any advantages that I can use to try to help it survive.
You know, first of all, this thing is like the town drunk, kind of staggering around, falling down in the gutter all over the place. And it also, it sounds like you've got it in a stockade of some kind.
I cemented steel pipes into the ground, and I wrapped it, and I tied it off with cable. But, of course, I put wood around the bark of the tree so the cable would not cut into the tree.
So you're going for the Martha Stewart Award in your neighborhood, huh?
Listen, it's my wife's favorite tree.
Oh.
I will do anything I can.
Okay, that changes everything. That changes everything. Are there still healthy leaves on it and everything?
This spring, it came alive fine. I mean, it grew, you know, the beautiful pink flowers.
Okay.
And leaves, and it seems to be growing now.
Okay, well then the tree is fine. If it leafed out fine and if it put on its flower show, it should be fine. We still have a tree that we can see the root flare of, right, at the base, or does it look like a popsicle now?
I can't see any roots. I've covered it over with garden soil and mulch.
Mm-hmm. That's not going to keep the roots in the ground, and if it's touching the trunk of the tree, that has to be pulled back.
It's not.
Okay. Any mulch should not be deeper than 2 inches.
Okay.
Or else it's going to prevent water from getting to the roots of the tree. I mean, it sounds like you've got it stabilized. You told me none of these cables are cutting into the bark, right?
That is correct.
And you hadn't been feeding it or doing anything special to it, had you? Had you always been mulching it?
Just once a year. And it's a thin layer of mulch. It's not a really, really thick layer. You know, it's about what you described.
You've been using wood mulch around the base about an inch every year.
That is correct.
The only thing you can do for this tree is to get rid of that wood mulch, which won't do the tree any good, won't help it root or anything like that. Replace that with an inch of yard waste compost.
Okay.
That will take over as the mulch. It'll provide weed protection, it'll provide soil moisture retention, and it'll give the tree a little gentle feeding of compost tea every time it rains. Don't let any kind of chemical fertilizers near the tree. Don't let grass grow near the tree or anything like that. Is there anything else growing in this raised bed?
Yes. There are three ornamental shrubs around it.
And what are they?
Rhododendrons.
So your rhododendrons are done blooming. This is a great time to move them. Replace them with hostas. Just coincidentally, I have a big flowering crabapple in a raised bed in my driveway that I inherited, and it's surrounded by hostas. And not only do the two plants get along well together, the hostas don't seem to damage the tree at all, but the tree provides the shade the hostas need, and I've had to remove some of them, and their roots move right next to the tree roots and encircle them and intertwine them. And I have a feeling that in your situation, the roots of the hostas could help hold down the roots of the crabapple. Get those rhododendrons out of there now. You can still plant hostas now. I think you'll see that kind of pinning effect of the roots helping each other out by next spring.
Oh, that's great news. That is really, really, really great news. Thank you.
All right, Bill. Your game to lose, man.
All righty. Thank you.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce my final two appearances of the spring season. I'll be talking about pest and weed control at the Companion Plant in Kutztown, PA on Saturday evening, June 9th, and revealing how to get your lawn off drugs on Sunday, June 24th at the Earth Fair in Burlington County, New Jersey. But don't go looking for all the details at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to make old glory out of blooming trees. I'm Bloomin' Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee offers seeds and live plants, edibles, flowers and perennials, treasured heirlooms, and high-performing hybrids. More information online at burpee.com.
You're listening to WHYY-FM.
Morris Arboretum supports WHYY and invites visitors to experience summer as it used to be with its new exhibit, Take a Seat, Adirondack Chairs Reinterpreted. More than 35 artists have created 70 unique Adirondack chairs that will be on exhibit at Morris Arboretum and at Woodmere Art Museum now through Labor Day. Morris Arboretum celebrates summer and encourages visitors to take a seat and take in the summer landscape. More info at morrisarboretum.org.
WHYY presents Video Production in the Classroom, a course for teachers grades 7 through 12 on June 9th. More information is available at whyy.org/teachers.
Hey everybody, Jad here. I wanted to let you know that Radiolab is coming soon to Philadelphia for a live show. We're calling it In the Dark, and it's all about darkness and light, seeing, believing. It's going to be a super fun night because we've got the comedian Dimitri Martin coming with us, the singer-songwriter Tao Nguyen, and the amazing dance troupe Palabolas. They'll all be there. We'll be there June 29th at the Academy of Music. You can get tickets at radiolab.org.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a really clever fellow wants to make the world's biggest living flag out of blooming trees, but of course he hit a wall when he looked for trees that bloom in blue. We'll tell you what we suggest for this fella when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, it's all your fascinating, fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Donna, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Oh, you are welcome, Donna. Where is Donna?
In Avalon, New Jersey.
Cooler by a mile, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's one of the great shore resorts down the Jersey Shore, one of my favorites. What can we do? And by the way, do you have a house near the beach, Donna?
Yes, we're on the bay.
Yeah, but how much of a walk to the beach? Let's get serious.
Not far. We're on Ocean Drive, and so we're two blocks.
Oh, okay, that's not bad.
I can see the ocean from my house.
Okay, good, good. I'll be checking in the week of July. Okay. All right, what can we do for Donna, two blocks from the Atlantic?
What you can do for me is to make our tomatoes win our annual tomato contest.
Oh, tell me about the contest. What are the rules and everything?
Well, the rules of the contest is basically that they be grown here on the island, and that basically they bring the tomatoes, and the tomatoes are only judged by taste. Looks have nothing to do with it.
Is this your first year entering the contest?
No. We've been holding the contest for over 25 years, and we have never won. We are the hosts, and we have it at our house every year. Same cast of characters show up. They grow their tomatoes. Most of the people do not grow them from seed. Unfortunately or fortunately, we grow them from seed. And the plants look gorgeous. They never get end rot. The actual fruit looks really good, but we never win based on tasting.
Okay.
It's a blind tasting.
I will tell you right now that flavor is variety driven. It is equally important how you grow the tomatoes. Equally important is picking a variety known for the high complexities of both sugars and acids. That's what you're looking for in a taste test. Not a sweet tomato, but a tomato whose sugars and acids are perfectly balanced with a lot of complex other notes mixed in there. So right away, I'm going to ask you, what varieties are you growing?
We're growing Supersonic for, a regular tomato, and we grow Sweet Million for, little grape tomatoes. And I will mention that a lot of the people who enter have in the past grown Supersonics and won first place, but we always come in last or second to last.
Okay, so how do you grow your plants? Are they in raised beds or flat ground?
They're in a raised bed. Our soil composition is we have 50% topsoil and 50% leaf mulch. And the beds are situated so that it's north-south, but they do get about 6 to 8 hours of sun every day.
And this is not an issue with the look of the tomatoes. You said you don't get blossom end rot, so you got some calcium in there.
That's right. Yeah, you told us to do this last year and on your show because we listened to you faithfully. You had said to put some bone meal in the hole when we are planting the tomatoes, and we've done that.
Oh, well, that won't hurt your plants, but that's not what I suggested.
Oh.
I suggested you save up your eggshells and put the crushed shells of a dozen eggs in the planting hole. That seems to supply calcium in a very elemental form, and that helps the flavor pop, too. Now, you say you've got half topsoil, and I presume you meant compost made from fall leaves.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you feed the plants throughout the season?
Not usually.
Okay.
They don't seem to need it.
This season, I want you to get a nice liquid fertilizer, a fish and seaweed mix.
Okay.
You can find these at better garden centers. Give them a light feeding, you'll put a couple of glugs in a watering can, and then you'll water your tomatoes with them. Do that once a month. Right now, the only thing we can do is try to get them some real calcium. So I do want you to find some eggshells somewhere, air dry them for like 48 hours, crush them up and try to get them down into the soil, like on top of the root ball. I want you to do the supplemental feeding, but don't overdo it, and certainly no chemical plant foods near them. Here's another tip for you. Tomatoes lose flavor rapidly in the heat. If you're letting them sit on the vine in the sun after they've ripened up, they begin to lose flavor dramatically. Mm-hmm. So what you need to do for the tomatoes you're going to enter on the taste test, the day before the taste test, if these tomatoes are like 99% colored up, pick them first thing in the morning after a cool night, even if you have to leave them sit out on the counter. Never put them in a sunny windowsill. Never expose them to heat. Never expose them to cold. But if you pick them first thing in the morning after a cool evening, that will concentrate the sugars in the fruit. It'll be much sweeter than if you had picked it in the middle of a hot afternoon or in the early evening as they're just starting to cool down.
Excellent.
So don't let them get dead ripe on the vine and sit in the sun. Pick them first thing in the morning after a cool night. And again, even if it means letting them sit out on the counter, but protect them from heat and light. And let's see how you do this year with the supplemental feedings and the couple of picking tips.
Okay, sounds good. And listen, if you're down here at Labor Day, that's when the contest is, you can definitely come and taste.
Save me a room with that ocean view you talked about.
You wouldn't be sorry. Thank you so much.
All right, take care, Donna.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Lynn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Lynn. Where are you, sir?
I am located in East Tennessee near Jonesboro, Tennessee.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Lynn in Tennessee?
I had a great garden last year. I'll bet you, Mike, there were 1,000 June bugs on my corn.
Now, when you say June bugs, you mean one of the scarab beetles, like Japanese beetles, rose chafer bugs. They all kind of look the same.
Yeah, what are they? Half inch long, they're green.
There's this large class of beetles that are called scarab beetles. Most people know the Japanese beetles, but there's also an oriental version, like Japanese isn't oriental, right? And then there's June bugs, rose chafer beetles. It's actually a big family, but they all have grubs in the soil that are laid in midsummer, and then those grubs hatch early the next spring and become adult beetles, and they can be a tenacious pest.
Yes, and I just went out one morning, and I'd venture to say 1,000 June bugs on the corn I had.
And you time. Say on your corn. Were they eating the tassels? Were they eating the silks?
No, the corn. They had burrowed into the corn around the skin.
They had actually gone through the husk and were
yes.
eating the kernels?
Yes.
These are tough bugs, Lynn.
Uh-huh. They certainly are.
So are we talking field corn or sweet corn?
Silver Queen, peaches and cream.
Oh, I love peaches and cream, baby. Uh-huh. Oh,
yeah.
That's a great sweet corn.
And yellow sweet, uh-huh. Those three.
What do you feed your sweet corn?
I have access to manure.
What kind of manure?
I have a choice of horse manure or cow manure.
Okay, and with sweet corn, I'm going to tell you right now, you would always go with the horse manure.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, because horse manure is high in nitrogen. That's the only food the sweet corn wants. Are you using it when it's fresh?
No.
Okay, so it's composted.
Yes.
It's been sitting around. Composted horse manure, and Lynn, you can put 2 inches of this stuff down. Corn just loves it, and you can put another 2 inches down in, like, late June. That may be good, but I'm still worried about these beetles. Now, when you till up your soil, have you seen grubs?
You know, I don't really know, Mike. I can't answer that question because I am a prayer planter. You know what I mean?
Right. And they've been a problem in multiple years or just last year?
Just last year with
just
that.
Just last year. Boy, I wish you would talk to me last year. I would have urged you to put milky spore disease down on all that soil at the end of the summer. That would have naturally controlled any grubs who were breeding underground. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. I want you to go and get a single Japanese beetle trap for each of your corn plantings. And ignore the instructions on putting it, like, in a flyway nearby or something like that. Just put it right next to the plants, and I want you to check it every day.
Mm-hmm.
The first time you find a Japanese beetle in any of the traps, take the traps down and hide them in the basement. Wrap them up in plastic to use them next year. And that's the time that you would spray any kind of a deterrent on the plants, any kind of an organic insecticide, because that's when the beetles are getting ready. And if you prevent them from feeding on your corn right away, if you just prevent them from feeding on it for a couple of weeks, they'll go someplace else and they will not come back. So you could spray the plants with, like, a garlic oil. There's a product called Garlic Barrier that's been used in organic farming for many, many years for just this purpose, to change the smell and the taste of the plants so the beetles are confused. You could spray them with the organic insecticide spinosad. That would be the active ingredient, would be the word S-P-I-N, OSAD. And it comes under a huge number of brand names now. It is totally harmless to you, totally harmless to beneficial insects, but it will first deter any insect from chewing, and if the insect chews anyway, after a couple of mouthfuls, they get dead.
Okay.
And same with neem, N-E-E-M. That would have the same effect. To maximize it, have the traps out. Catch the first beetle. This is how real professional farmers use insect traps as monitors.
Yes.
To tell them when it's about to happen. You spray them for like 2 weeks, keeping that smell up or the spinosad or the neem on the plant. And then after those 2 weeks, in 90 cases out of 100, you can simply stop and the beetles will have established other feeding territories by then. But
okay.
What happens if you don't get them right away is when the first beetles start feeding on your corn, they actually secrete a pheromone that attracts other beetles there in a literal feeding frenzy. So you have to stop that initial onslaught and get the feeding frenzy on some neighboring farm.
That's great.
All right, good luck, sir.
Yes, thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you. Take care, man.
You too.
1-888-346-9499. Maggie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, how are you?
I am well today, Maggie. I trust you are.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
And where is Maggie well?
I am in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for Maggie?
My hydrangea has these white... At first, I thought it was mold. Now, I'm not so sure that it's mold. And it might be like a little caterpillar kind of worm. It's very tiny, and it's white, and it is all over my hydrangea. And it has begun killing the plant.
Okay, so you've got white. That much we know. Top of the leaves, under the leaves, on the stem of the plant.
It is everywhere, but it began at the bottom of the leaves, at the stem.
There are many things that could be going on here. There are a number of insects that almost look like mold or mildew that are smothering insects. Let's drop back. How long have the hydrangeas been in the ground?
9 years.
9 years. Do they get good sun and good airflow?
Yes.
And what do you feed them and or mulch them?
I don't. I just water them.
Oh, okay. And when you water them, do you water at the base or do you wet the leaves?
I water at the base always.
Okay. But there's no compost, no nothing underneath?
Well, I compost the entire garden every year, but not them specifically.
Okay. And what color do they bloom?
Blue.
Oh, okay. So are you acidifying the soil?
No, I think it's acidy to begin with.
It must be. Have you at least tried to rustle the leaves of the plants?
I have, and I even tried squirting it with a hose like you would with aphids, trying to get them off.
Right, and?
It didn't do anything. In fact, I think it made it worse. I think they kind of fed off the water.
No. That wouldn't... mold or mildew would get worse sometimes with moisture. When do they get their first sun? What time of day?
That area always gets the early morning, early day sun. It's going south.
So you did rustle the plants and nothing went flying into the air.
Oh, it flies all over like snow, yes.
Oh, those are white flies, Maggie.
Is that what they are?
Yeah, that's a white fly infestation that has unfortunately nothing to do with caterpillars, or else we could just spray BT on them. White fly is a very notorious greenhouse pest on the West Coast and down in southern Florida. It's a year-long pest outdoors, which is excruciating for those poor people. Here in the Northeast, they tend to die out over winter, but I don't remember us getting a winter. And it's you say your whole plant is covered and the plant is in decline, right?
I've cut it back.
No. That's overreaction. You're stressing the plant further. There are two organic insecticides that you could use that would knock these pests down right away. One is you would look for an organic insecticide whose active ingredient is spinosad, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. It's available under a huge number of brand names, and I see it at virtually every big garden center I go to. The other is neem, N-E-E-M. Very safe for humans, very safe for the environment, doesn't harm birds or earthworms. it's very good for these what are called sucking pests. They, you know, as you see, they're smothering the plant. They're sucking the life out of it.
That's exactly what they're doing.
I would be more aggressive in shooting them off the plant with sharp streams of water, not wetting them down.
Okay.
And you want to get up close, cradle the plant with one hand, and blast them off. I would do a blast off with water, followed by a spray of spinosad. And the most important thing is don't prune anymore. Don't cut anymore. Let the plant recover. Because 9 times out of 10, these pests do not return the following year. This is generally a one-time thing.
Okay.
And then if you get them down to small numbers, have you ever seen the yellow sticky traps they sell for houseplants?
Yes.
These pests are tremendously attracted to the color yellow. So once you get the numbers down, put some yellow sticky traps all around your plants, and you'll trap the newly emerging ones.
Oh.
So give them a knockdown with the water, follow that with a good thorough spray of spinosad, and then put out some yellow sticky traps and let the plants recover. Obviously, they're not going to look great this year, but there's no reason to give them up. You can get ahead of this pest, and it won't come back. It'll die this winter.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mike.
All right.
You helped me a great deal.
Well, thank you, Maggie. Good luck.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and invite garden groups, botanic show places, and the like to submit news of their upcoming events of interest to gardeners to us for inclusion in a new feature. If you're in an area where our show is broadcast locally, we'll consider your event for an on-air mention and a web page listing. But don't go looking for all the details at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with how to make a living flag out of blooming trees and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee has been providing gardeners with seeds, plants, and supplies for growing everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs for over a century. More information online at burpee.com.
This is WHYY-FM.
The University of Delaware's MBA program offered at the Alfred Lerner College of Business and Economics supports WHYY, now accepting applications for the fall semester. The UD MBA is AACSB accredited and designed for flexibility with full and part-time options and evening classes held in Newark and Wilmington. Scholarships are available for qualified candidates as well as other benefits for applicants with GMAT scores over 600. UDGradBiz.com or 302-831-1200.
The Mann Center supports WHYY and presents the Philadelphia Orchestra live in concert Wednesday, June 27th. It's Beethoven's Ninth Symphony featuring the Philadelphia singers and soloists from the Academy of Vocal Arts. Then on Friday, June 29th, it's the Mann Summer Tradition with the orchestra, the All Tchaikovsky Spectacular with fireworks. Tickets for the Philadelphia Orchestra live in concert at the Mann are available at manncenter.org or 215-893-1999.
The WHYY Young Journalist Summer Camp provides hands-on multimedia journalism experience for teens. Sessions are available in June and August. You can register today at whyy.org/camps. It's 70 degrees in Center City at 11:39.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Someone is planning to grow the world's largest American flag using blooming trees for the colors. But where are you going to get blue? We'll tell you our answer after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Joan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Joan. How are you?
I'm doing well in St. George's.
In Sault Ste. George?
No, St. George's, Delaware, just by the canal.
Right. Well, isn't there a South St. George and a North St. George?
Oh, you're right on top of things. Yes, sir. We are in actually George's Heights, which is a quarter mile from North St. George's.
My brother lives in Virginia Beach, and so every year we make the pilgrimage down. In the old days, I loved that old bridge that took you over Sault Ste. George, and now they have that really stunning architectural bridge next to it, and I believe the little bridge reopened to local traffic, right?
That is correct. No heavy trucks, and it really cuts down on the amount of problems that we have with noise pollution here on St. George's on the north side.
I think next time I drive down there, I'm going to do a dog leg. I want to go over that little bridge again. I have such fond memories of it, and that'll give me a better view of the crazy bridge whose supports are just these pipes going up in the air.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think they call it a butterfly bridge, but I'm not sure.
It really is beautiful. But, I mean, when you're driving over it, you don't get the full effect. All right.
True.
Well, Sault Ste. George, one of my favorite places. What can we do for Joan?
I am trying to figure out how you take the pods from tulips that have been blooming every year. I don't have to dig them up. They come up every year. And make them into new bulbs. What is the process of taking the pods that are left over to get them to become tulip bulbs?
Right. So after the flowers fade, they're replaced by a seed head. And I will tell you that the professionals who grow tulips for sale always clip off those seed pods.
Mm-hmm.
Because you may get a pleasant surprise if you do try to dig up a couple of your tulips. If your tulips are open pollinated, that is, they are not hybrid varieties,
mm-hmm.
The ones you can do this with would be all the species tulips and all the kind of unaltered tulips. Hybridization is not genetic engineering. It goes back centuries. But if you have hybrid tulips, which would not be uncommon, the seeds would not come true. You would not be able to get the same tulips from them. It is my understanding from conversations I had with the Dutch back when I traveled through Holland that it is laborious and it is time-consuming and it takes many, many years. But if you have open-pollinated non-hybrid tulips, you can clip off those seed pods. Like any seed-saving endeavor, you would always let the seed pods go, you know, forever until they almost fell off the plant so that you would be sure the seeds had matured. And then you would open them up and you will see seeds inside. And then you would just treat those as if they were tulips, because in nature, some of the spring bulbs could also reproduce this way. This was not their first method of reproduction. But sometimes, you know, well, obviously up in the mountains, the godforsaken mountains of Afghanistan and Turkey where these things are native, the seed pods would always finish maturing and fall down, maybe be eaten by an animal, taken somewhere else. But then they would go through the natural cycle of dormancy. And in the spring, instead of a tulip coming up, a very tiny plant would come up. And it would just be, you know, have enough leaves to collect a little solar energy. It would die off when the tulips died off. And it's my understanding, after about 6, 7, maybe 8 years, it might get large enough to produce a flower. Whereby, what the professionals do who are growing these, they make sure that the tulip bulbs are down in a very loose soil. And the way they reproduce normally is to create what are called bulblets, miniature tulip bulbs that grow off what we would then call the mother bulb. And if your plants have been in the ground for a long time, I would bet you dollars to donuts that your underground bulbs have a lot of little babies ringing around them. If you take these babies, and once the tulips have died back to the ground completely, once all their greenery is done, you can dig them up without harm. You would examine a couple of bulbs, and I predict there's going to be clusters of 6 or 7 babies around the mother bulb. You can put the mother bulb right back in the ground. Take these little bulblets and store them inside for a brief period of time over the summer. Just pack them in peat moss or perlite and then plant them after Halloween the way you would as if it were a fresh spring bulb you had bought at a garden center. The following year, you'll get a much larger plant than you would from the seeds off these bulblets, probably just leaves that first year. But then either the second or third year after that, these bulblets would be flowering. And because they are the straight genetic children of the mother bulb, they would be true no matter what. Even a hybrid would bloom the same flower as long as you're using these underground children, whereby the seed might not.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mike.
All right. Thank you, Joan. Very interesting question.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Denise, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Denise. Where are you?
I'm in the suburbs of Chicago.
And what suburb of Chicago?
In Naperville.
Naperville. Okay. What can we do for Denise just outside one of our nation's most fun cities?
It is, actually.
So what can we do for you, Denise?
Well, I'm calling because our family is pursuing the purchase of a horse farm, and we're getting very close.
Okay.
And one of the things that we're thinking about is our manure management.
Absolutely.
And my mom used to call horse manure black gold. And I'm convinced that there's something that we can do with all the horse manure from 20 horses that will allow us to maybe address another problem. And the problem that I want to address is some standing water in an area where we have trails. But I'm not quite sure if and how, and so I was hoping that you could help me think it through.
Okay. Horse manure, once it's completely composted, is a great fertilizer. But it is very high in nitrogen. It's not a balanced fertilizer. So you never want to use horse manure when it's fresh, when it's still hot and it's still smelly. So when we talk about horse manure and poultry manure, we're typically talking about the material the animal was done with and the bedding that captured it. And then what is done is you muck out the stalls, as you probably know by now, and you take this material and you pile it somewhere. And over time, it will lose its objectionable odor. It won't be hot to the touch anymore. And when it does look like rich black super soil, it's ready to use. You can't use raw manure, not for any health reasons, but it's full of weed seeds. So if the material isn't fully composted, it grows a garden of weeds. Especially on a farm like yours where you have control over the horses, you have a control over the beddings, I would absolutely say to set up a system where it can be composted, maybe turned once or twice to move the composting along. Typically, people will have a baby backhoe or some sort of a winnowing machine to move the manure along if they have a lot of it, and that way it gets composted down. You know, in the summertime, this stuff could be ready to distribute in like 6 weeks, whereby over the winter
that's
it's
quick.
Well, that's if you've got good weather and you're turning it every couple
right.
of days to move it along. Even just sitting in a big pile alone, it will, over the course of a season, become beautiful, crumbly, no smell whatsoever. But spreading horse manure around the trails is not going to improve the drainage. What you'd have to do if water is pooling up on trails, and you'd want to get rid of this for many reasons, you know, just creature comfort and to reduce the number of mosquito breeding sites, you would rent a machine or buy a machine, in your case, called a core aerator that would pull plugs out of those trails, and that would improve the drainage, and you wouldn't have the standing water. And then if you want naturally some the local flora to move in and kind of decorate the trail, once you improve the drainage, plants will naturally migrate into that trail. And there could be springs under there. This could be a very natural. This could be a
yeah.
very natural phenomena, and you don't want to introduce nitrogen contamination to what could be maybe eventually your own water source. On this farm.
Oh, my goodness.
If it's naturally puddling and there's natural vernal ponds, I would just get some mosquito dunks, the BTI mosquito dunks. They're totally natural. Toss a dunk into each of these standing water things in the springtime to prevent mosquitoes breeding. And these little vernal ponds are great breeding sites for birds and butterflies and frogs and toads and turtles. And
I was talking to one of the fellows who does those mosquito things, and he suggested that. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about maybe even, I never thought about it being a natural spring. And
if it stays wet for a long time in the spring, I can guarantee you that frogs and toads are breeding there.
And I don't want to eliminate that.
And that other natural creatures are using that resource. Water is life. And the nice thing about the BTI mosquito dunks or the granules is it doesn't harm anything other than mosquitoes who are breeding in the water. Frogs and toads have a wonderful time.
Wow, this is great. Oh, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Good luck. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Blue blooms for a living flag. Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer, read us this week's very interesting question.
Well, that it is. Chuck in Russellville, Tennessee writes, I'm working on a project that would create the world's largest American flag using blooming trees to create the design from an aerial view. I've been leaning towards red and white crepe myrtles for the stripes as they have a long bloom time, but haven't been able to pin down a tree with blue flowers. I'm willing to forego using trees for the blue field plants if I must, but my biggest concern is having all three colors in bloom at the same time of the year, and the longer the bloom, the better. Can you guide me in my search?
Well, as Chuck has already learned, searching the internet for, quote, trees with blue flowers pretty much yields two things. Tropical trees whose flowers are nicely blue, but that can only survive, and only maybe survive, in regions without real winters. And trees whose blue flowers sure look purple to me. So I asked a few experts for their advice. The first plant that came to the mind of Holly Shimizu, executive director of the U.S. Botanic Garden in Washington, D.C., was blue Atlas cedar. Now, it doesn't produce blue flowers, but it is a tree, and a number of selections of this outstanding evergreen have needles that are truly blue. Cedars should do well in northeastern Tennessee. The trees would always be blue, which is very appropriate as the blue in our flag stands for vigilance and perseverance, and they'd be joined by the red and white parts when the crepe myrtles bloom in summer. Now, the blue of the cedars might seem a little subdued comparatively, but fireworks can seem subdued next to some crepe myrtles. Holly's other idea was to delve into the world of crepe myrtle breeders to see if anybody's trying to move the purple-flowered types more towards the blue end of the spectrum, specifically directing me to Margaret Pooler, a research geneticist at the National Arboretum, also located in our nation's capital, who has been involved in mapping the decorative tree's genetic structure. Unfortunately, she reports that the genes that control flower color in crepe myrtle can't produce any kind of a real blue. The purple/lavender varieties are as close as you're going to get. So we then asked Scott Aker, head horticulturalist at the Natural Arboretum, and his top choice was blue-flowering Rose of Sharon, pruned into the tree form that these hibiscus family members so easily achieve with some sharp intervention. The flowers are big, really blue, and should be in bloom at the right time, he notes. I'll add that back when I was the editor-in-chief, a story we ran on Blue Flowers in Organic Gardening magazine identified the variety Bluebird as a great blue Rose of Sharon. But when I personally think of big blue flowers in the summertime, I think of hydrangeas. The bloom time is fairly consistent with crepe myrtles. The flowers are huge, and it's easy to, quote, make the blooms blue by keeping their soil acidic, which I do with a yearly application of peat moss covered with compost. Hydrangeas tend to max out at 6 to 8 feet in height, but there are dwarf cultivars of crepe myrtle that could be kept trained to around that size without committing the crepe murder that would be needed to keep full-size trees in check. The U.S. Botanic Gardens' Holly Shimizu liked my hydrangea idea so much, she said she was sorry that our listener had specified trees. You could get a really nice flag out of hydrangeas alone, she notes. The white-flowered ones are always white, and the standard types can be made to flower either red or blue by manipulating their soil pH. And they're all the same type of plant, so you'd know they'd all be in bloom at the same time, and for a good long time. And it would probably be a lot less expensive of an endeavor. I just took a serious map-like look at an image of our flag, and that's a lot of lumber if it's all colored out in trees. It would take 50 white crepe myrtle just to make up the stars at one crepe per state, and a huge amount more if you're using trees to make the much longer and more densely planted six white stripes. Around 1,000 trees by my eyeballing and estimating, and that's only if you get the planting distance close to perfect. And you'd need around 15% more red-blooming myrtles to make up the seven red stripes of the flag. And then there's the potential need for replacement plants, and that's where I think the hydrangeas really shine. You can pop new shrubs in the ground a lot easier than having to uproot and replace a tree. A little support for the big flower heads, a little trellising to clean up the outside of the stars, you could make them look like real five-pointers from the sky, and you'd get solid, bold color from about the same number of plants, but at much less cost. Well, those sure were some interesting ideas about how to achieve a living field of blue, now weren't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to run me up the flagpole if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line. And perhaps check Voiced to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Don't Call Me Merv Griffin. Our webmaster is Baneful Rich Banowitz. His faithful internet companion is Sarah Kazar. Star-spangled Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant is All-American Kelly Haggerty. Proudly waves our esteemed editor, Al Banks. I'm a star short and a couple of stripes late, Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. What's going on when a grass of a different color spreads like wildfire in a lawn? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal what to do when invasive Bermuda grass takes over your turf, plus your fabulous phone calls.
You're listening to WHYY-FM.
Newman University supports WHYY and encourages listeners to discover how a master's degree in pastoral counseling can help prepare adults.